and just produce like a new kind of condensed Gomorrah, which is just the halakhic bottom line. So he basically went through the Gomorrah with a wipeout pen, and he just took out all the stuff that he didn't think was halakhic, the conclusion. Now, it's not the Gomorrah, it's a different book, he made it into his own book. But at the back of the Gomorrah, standing Gomorrah, is principally real, which is, again, the beginning of what we call the codification, attempting to come to the bottom line. Very often the Gomorrah gives two or three opinions. He'll only quote the opinion that we follow. Yeah? It has a page and a half of analysis. He'll just cut through that whole thing and say the conclusion is X. That was the beginning of that process. I did Rashi, in actual knowledge at the same time, did something different. It took you by the hand, explained what the Gomorrah meant. Go to the next century. The most important person in this whole thing is the Rambam. We'll talk for a minute about the Rambam. In 1100 to 1200, the Rambam lived in Spain, and then he lived in North Africa, lived for a while in Israel. He did something totally new and radical. And listen to what the Rambam did, because the Rambam is the foundation really of the Shulchan Aruch of modern style. The Rambam said, I'm going to do the following. I'm going to hoover into my enormous brain the entirety of the oral law. The Gemara, Bavli, Yerushalmi, all the Midrashim, all the other stuff that was left out of the Gemara in different books, etc., etc. I'm going to upload every single thing to my brain. I'm going to reformat it, and I'm going to download it into a new formatted book, which is called the Mishneh Torah, which Mishneh means second to the Torah. And he writes his introduction, but now all you need is two books in the whole world. You need the Sefer Torah, which is the written law, and you need the Mishneh Torah, the second in command of the Torah, which is the oral law, which is my book. And now you don't need a Gemara anymore, he said, because I've given you the answer to every halakhic question conceivable. Not practical questions, every question. He includes, of course, all the practical halakha, but he also includes the halakha of the Beit HaMikdash, ritual purity and impurity. He includes all the halakha of the Mashiach, the halakha of how to fight a war and a Amalek, and everything. Everything's there that you'll ever need until Mashiach comes and beyond. Because that's my book. No one before had ever done that, and no one since has ever done that. And it's unbelievable how he was able to do it, because he had to learn through every single Gemara, every single source in Chazal, and decide what the halakha was. He doesn't give any sources, he doesn't give any opinions, he just writes it in a very linear format. Now, on the one hand, the Rambam was a revolution that completely excited the Jewish world. On the other hand, it was very controversial. You know, what's going to be? People are not going to learn the Gemara. Who says your opinion is right? You didn't give any sources. How do we know where you got it from? And many commentaries came upon the Rambam trying to work out, well, how did the Rambam get to this? Where did he learn this from? Why did he pass him the way he passed him? But the Rambam ultimately produced that behind his other head. Is that right?
Yes.
Behind his other head is that instead of red books, it says Rambam on the label there. That is the Rambam. That is the 14 books of the Mishneh Torah. Yad HaChazakah. Yad is the 14th. It's also the Gematria of Javid, who is his brother, who he dedicated it to. His brother died in the shipwreck. It's a whole story, which is not for now. But the Rambam produced that book. And that became, if you like, one of the most central works of Halakha that there is. Now a lot of things after that were based on the Rambam. At the same time, in France and Germany, you have the Baliyat Tosfos, but Rashbam and Ben Tam, the Reem, and these other people who were doing a similar but different exercise. And when analyzing the Talmud, their commentary standardly is now found around the Gemara. If you open a standard page of Gemara, you will find always in this modern print the Gemara down the middle, Rashi on the inside track, okay, on the inside of the page, and Tosfos on the outside track. Now, why exactly Rashi and Tosfos are around the Gemara on the print? It's a bit random as to how the printers chose to print it. Okay, it could have been other people. But it was, it turned out to be. And then other people at the back. You must understand that a lot of what you find in the Gemara is not actually in the Gemara. A lot of it is commentary, all the boards are back. They know different means doing different things. Okay, the Rift is always there, other people are always there. So, this is a continuation of the process of the Rishon. Go over the page, please. And look, you'll see other people whose names you'll recognize. Carvel is the 1300, the Ramban in the Sephardi land, the Rashbam in Israel, in the Ashkenazi land, the Maharam of Rothenburg, who is very, very famous, has a whole life story. Again, I could speak for an hour on each of these people, and I'd be happy to, but we're not going to be able to get anything done that way. I just want to point out two more people. In the next century, 13 to 1400, there's the Rosh and the Tor. The Rosh, Rabbi Asher, lived in Germany. He was the student of the Maharam of Rothenburg, and he was the student of the last of the Tosafists, the Baliyat Tosafists. The Rosh produced a similar thing to the Rambam, but in a different way. He produced it at the back of the Gemara, he summarized the Halacha, etc.
So the Ashkenazim, the Rosh became a bit like the Rambam was for the Sfarim. Yeah? It wasn't quite as all-extensive, it was only on practical things, on that offer, but the Rosh became very, very big codification. And these weren't the only ones. There were lots of other people who produced these codifications, and they were followed by the people in their locality. The Rosh was in Germany, therefore the Jews in Germany, Paschal Halacha, based on the Talmud, like the understanding of the Rosh. The Rambam lived in North Africa, so the Jews of North Africa and Spain passed it like the Rambam, based on the understanding of the Rambam. And everyone's happy. Yeah, everyone's happy, everyone knows what they're doing, they're living in a fairly stable environment, from, let's say, the year 900 through to the year 1500. The Ashkenazim, however, were very small as a community at the beginning. They were only the same, the number of Ashkenazim at the time of Rashi is the same as the number of Jews that live in Har-Nof. That's why we're all Ashkenazim extended from a very, very small gene pool, which is why we have all these funny kind of genetic issues like Tay-Sachs and all that kind of stuff, whereas the Sephardim don't have that. The Sephardim numbered millions, while the Ashkenazim numbered tens of thousands, and then the Sephardim are from a very, very much broader gene pool. Of course, there's other people as well. The Yemenites, they're doing their own thing as well, but they're very into the Rambam for historical reasons, personal reasons. They were so into the Rambam, they like adopted it and said, ready for all time. Okay. And there's the Bukharians who are living, you know, in Uzbekistan, and they were doing their own thing as well. Yeah? They're all there as well. You know, there are all these different people living in different places. Now, I'm not doing this justice, but it's going to give you a feel. When we learn Gemara today, we learn with Rishonim. In fact, if we learn Gemara right, when you go to a good Gemara share, what they will teach you to do is as follows. I'm sure this is how to teach Gemara Chappell. Is you read the page of Gemara, or the line of Gemara, you try and work out what it means before you look at anyone else. Yeah? By the way, that's how you should learn Chumash as well. Don't learn Chumash with Rashi like this. Yeah? You don't learn Chumash like that, because if you learn Chumash with Rashi, you will never be able to understand the Chumash without Rashi. And then you'll be brainwashed by Rashi. Which is not a bad thing, but it's not the best thing. Which means that you'll think, you'll assume that the chat and the topic is the way that Rashi reads it, because you've been kind of... Whereas if you read it yourself and forget Rashi from the beginning, and try and understand based on your own understanding of grammar, context, the meaning of the word, what you think it means, now of course you may be wrong, but then you can look at the context and see what they think it means, and often you'll find out that you thought it meant like Rashi they interpreted, but your chavrusa understood it like the Rambam. And then you realize, oh, like, you know, I'm Rashi all the Rambam. It's not that. Yeah. Or you find nobody understood it like you understood it, and then you have to work out, am I just wrong, which is 99.99% likely, or did I come up with a brand new chat that nobody ever thought of before? It's possible. Okay? The same is with Gemara. You learn the Gemara yourself, and then you learn everyone around you. When I'm in Yeshiva, I'll stand in the stage of Gemara, if we're in the Gemara, then in the following order, Rashi, Tosfos, Rambam, Ritva, Rashba, sorry, Rambam, Rashba, Ritva, and then we learn the Rambam, and the Rosh, and then we go. Okay? Now you know why it takes so long to learn, because you're not just learning three lines tomorrow, you're learning what everybody else says about them. And you're running around finding the books, and you're doing a dynamic exercise. Yes.
But, I don't know, in some yeshivas, like, if you develop your own interpretation, and then your teacher says, no, like, you're wrong.
You argue with them.
Like, you know, what are you supposed to explain? Like, are you supposed to follow one certain answer, or are you supposed to establish your own meaning?
You're asking a good question. Now, 99.9% of the time when you're learning Gemara, you're not learning Gemara in order to know what the halacha is and therefore to rule on it. When it comes to halachic decisions, you don't base your halachic lifestyle on your own understanding of how the sources work. That's the danger of things to do. So when it comes to halacha, of course, I'm going to have to shine. I'm going to do what the, you know, the Rav says. But when it comes to understanding the Gemara, I want to understand the halacha and eventually come to an understanding of how the halacha works. So, yes, I mean, if you're arguing in a shiur with the Rosh Hashiva, by the way, all the gloves are off. If you really think that your chat is right, then you just argue with the Rosh Hashiva. And if he wants to fool you, then you don't take Christmas. And if you ask a stupid question, you'll be told in shiur. That's a stupid question. Don't open your mouth until you have a sensible question. And if you have low self-esteem, too bad. That's how it is. It's not like standard, you know. What's 2 plus 2? 6. That's a good answer. Does anyone else have another suggestion? Maybe not a suggestion, like, oh, we don't take prisoners, but I think the 18-year-old standard is like, everybody's on the bridge.
like it's not like that in Yeshiva stuff. If you don't like it, you drop out. It's not quite as bad. But anyway, the point is that we learned the Talmud with the Shonis. That's how we learn the Talmud. Yeah. I want to give you a very important historical point though. If you think of stature of the Jewish people in the year 1100, okay, life is hard, there's crusades and there's a lot of trouble. But basically people live in established communities, the Ashkenazim look at that for 200 years, the Sfarim have been there for 200 years, the same in 1200, 1300, they have their Masorah, they have their tradition. They Paskin like this based on their Rambam or based on the Gemara. If you take a snapshot of the Jewish world in 1600, everything's messed up. The Jews are thrown out of Spain. It's impossible for us to understand what a cataclysm that was. For millions of Jews. They've gathered in the same synagogue for 700 years. When's the last time you gathered in a shul where your family is gathered for 700 years? Most people today think Judaism only started in 1967. Yeah? It's a Hamasora, very deep roots. Yeah? How could they be Judaism before our scrolls? Couldn't be. What did they have? I don't know. What did they use? These people have ancient history. The Jews were thrown out of Spain. They were just evicted, or they went underground, they became Christians, or they pretended to be Christians. In the Ashkenazi world, the Black Death wiped out hundreds of thousands of Jews. It's impossible to overestimate how it gets decimated the community. 1340. And after the Black Death, because proportionally less Jews died in the Black Death, the non-Jews, because of all sorts of hygiene issues, so the non-Jews then started pogroms against the Black Death. Many Jews died after the Black Death because of enormous pogroms. You ever heard of the Rindfleisch massacres? Like, they're awful, awful things that affected the Jewish world. And therefore they fled. Where could they go? They can't go north. Where you live in, Germany, where are you going to go? Norway? I don't think so. Okay? They couldn't go, south, meet the Spanish coming back up to greet them. They went east. So the Jews fled to Poland, to Russia, to Latvia, to Lithuania, the kind of places that many of your great-great-grandparents probably came from. But they only went there in the 1500s. Now, from a halakhic oral law perspective, this made a big difference. Where's the Masorah? What do I do? I now live, whereas 200 years ago, the Jews lived in a little town in Barcelona, and they all knew what they were doing. Now, take a snapshot, there's Jews living somewhere in Turkey, and there's a Sephardi population, and there's some Ashkenazim mixed in, and there's some other people from Benares, some people from Salonika, and there's some people from not only in the Casablanca, and they've all got different than Hungary. What are they going to do? What are they going to follow? Which one is Allah? Hello then. No problem. Yeah, we can, if you wish. 5 minutes, good. Because I started late because I was late in traffic. 7. No problem, We'll stop for time. The Shulchan Aruch, therefore, came along. Rav Yosef Karo, two men at the same time woke up and said, you know something, we have to sort this out. In Ashkenazi land, in Poland, there was Rav Moshe Ichelis, who said, we need to bring all this together. We need to create a one unified self that's going to bind the Jewish people, because no one's ever all mixed up. And Rav Yosef Karo, living in Spain, in North Africa, in Western North Africa, where he ended up in Israel, he said the same thing. We need to create one unified sect for everybody. They both have the same idea independently at the same time. And they therefore started working on a unifying Jewish sect for everybody. Now, there was a messianic tinge to this as well, which I can't even get into now, after the expulsion from Spain. People thought the Shia was there, therefore they wanted to make a new Sanhedrin, and kind of restart the process, get back to the Talmudic times, and etc. That never happened for all sorts of political reasons, but the Shulchan Aruch did. And Rabbi Yosef Karo produced this book called the Shulchan Aruch, which was meant to be a sect for everybody. Ashkenazim, Sfarim, Yemenites, everybody. And basically what he did is he took the Rid, the Rosh, and the Rambam, and said, you know what? We're all three agreed, but now is the time. That's the halacha. Where two out of the Rid, the Rosh, and the Rambam, where two out of three agree, we'll go like that. Where only one, there's only one that they all disagree, so then we'll look at other things. And he started a whole new halachic kind of sack system like that. Very controversial. Not everybody agreed with it. People said, you can't pass a halacha like that. You have to learn it from the Talmud, like we always have. You can't start telling it with some kind of random group of people. Well, it's not really random, because the Rish, the Rosh, and the Rambam are probably the three greatest. But nevertheless, people didn't like it. But Moshe Ichelis, living in Poland, was halfway through writing his own Shulchan Aruch when he discovered that someone else had just finished one. He was devastated. He didn't know what to do. His whole life's work had just been done by someone else.
that he wrote to Rabbi Yosef Karo and said to him, we see the letter, he's got the correspondence, and said to him, look, you know, you've just written this book, it's amazing, and I agree with 85% of what's in it. But you know something, you've written it for the whole world, Ashkenaz and Ansfarim and everyone, and you base it on the Ritz, who was Sfardi, and the Rosh, who was Ashkenazi, and the Rambam, who was Sfardi. It's the old Sfardi time. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And it doesn't reflect entirely, says the Rosh Hashanah, the customs of the Ashkenazi living in Northern Europe. Then why suggest it was Sfardi? Do you mind, Mr. Yosef Karo, who said, Rabbi Yosef Karo, if I write into your book comments every now and then? You know, 95% I agree with. But every now and then I'm going to put in a comment and say, well, we do this, or we pack in this way, or this is a halakha for us. And Rabbi Yosef Karo said, no, that's fine, we'll do the book together, and they produced a complete book. And to this day, when you pick up a Shulchan Aruch, finished around 1550, it's in two fonts. There's the font, which is usually the square font, which is Rabbi Yosef Karo, and there's usually the what's called Rashi script. Rashi script's got nothing to do with Rashi. He didn't write it in Rashi script, that's a whole different story. Okay, and that in a Rashi script is usually the Ramot, from Moshe Gessler. And then what we have is a new book from the 1500s, which is meant to be the final word, the staff on for everybody. Now, as I said to you before, not everybody accepted it, not everybody liked it. People felt it was a shortcut. Rabbis don't need to be looking at two books, you know, looking at halacha and seeing what it is. They need to be learning the whole Talmud and working out for themselves. But you know something, when we often crowd says, what can we do? We're all over the world. We haven't got a head anymore. We're not as big as the early people were. That's all we need today. It was like the art scroll of his time. Yeah? It's, you know, the times require a new measure, separate measure. And that's how the Shulchan Aruch came into being. And pretty much the Jewish world went for it. With a few exceptions, and even today you find some rabbis who are less excited about following the Shulchan Aruch in all things. They do their own stamp, which is fine. But more or less, the Jewish world went for the Shulchan Aruch. And therefore, when you ask a rabbi a shaila, the way that shaila is answered is usually from the Shulchan Aruch, with the commentaries around the Shulchan Aruch explaining how the halacha is applying different circumstances. The Mishnah Brura, which you've heard of, I'm sure, is a modern, 100 years old, commentary on one part of the Shulchan Aruch, where he brings all of the different opinions together and different applications and different cases to just clarify what the halacha is. Mishnah Brura, the Chofetz Chaim wrote it, Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen Kagan. He lived in Russia about 100 years ago. Came down in the 1930s. So there are many commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. Mishnah Brura is just one. There are many others. And that is generally how a rabbi will pass in a shaila. But most shaila is standard shaila. He comes and says, Rabbi Manning, I brought my flesh exclusion, I don't keep washing up, and wash it all up together. What should I do? So it's a standard shaila. The answer is Shulchan Aruch. You either know it or you don't know it. If you know it, you just answer it. When big questions come up today, unusual questions, out-of-the-box questions, like the surrogate, you know, motherhood questions, like who's the mother, the first mother is your next mother, you can't look that one up in Shulchan Aruch. They go to poskim, meaning people who still pass in halacha based on the understanding of the Talmud. People like Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Avi Yosef, people like that, the big guns in each generation. And when you read their tshuvas, you'll see they don't just say, you know, answer the shaila, well, look at the Shulchan Aruch, page 19, here it is. They say, let's go through all the sugyas, let's go through all the gemaras, and let's analyze them all together, and they come up with a sack based on all that analysis. And that's still how halacha works today. The Shulchan Aruch is obviously very important as part of that process, but it's not necessarily the end of the process. Okay? And that's how things work today. Minhag, don't worry about it. Minhag is a totally different thing. Minhag is not created by poskim. Minhag is created by communities. And it's therefore not found in books. It finds its way into books when people write about what minhagim are, but minhagim are started by people. The way that people dress, the rules of tzniut, the customs that people have in shuls and things like that, these are all minhagim. They are not found in the halacha. And therefore, you know, don't ask questions as to, you know, did Moshe Rabbeinu say that we should wear open-toed sandals or closed-toed sandals? Or like, Moshe Rabbeinu had nothing to say on the matter. The local minhag defines the halakha, and therefore minhag works in a slightly different way. It's part of the halakhic process, but it's not really from the books, in the same way that the rest of the halakha is. It kind of plugs it in somehow. Okay? I'll say one more thing, and then I'll take questions for the last, like, 20 minutes, since I was going to say earlier. The last thing I would say is like this. Even though the Shulchan Aruch passed it, he ruled like one of the opinions, Rish, Rosh, Rambam, those other opinions are still out there. all those other Rishonim. The Ritzvah and the Ramban and the Rashbah and the all the Ruah and the this one and the that one. Some of them. What about them? The answer is they're still there. And they are what we call Chumras and Kulas. Okay, leniencies and stringencies. The Chumra is a stringency and the Kula is a leniency. If you decide, for whatever reason, and if one has to know when it's appropriate when it's not, that you want to follow the view of the Rashbah on this issue, even though the Shulchan Aruch is more lenient than the Rashbah, but you feel it's right for you to be strict, you want to take on an extra opinion, fine, you can do that in certain circumstances. You can't make up your own opinion, open up a tab and think, well, I think we all ought to, you know, not eat beans on Thursday. And that's not one of the opinions that we're showing. Every corner that people keep is another opinion of the Rishonim that we do normally don't follow, that they choose to follow, for whatever reason. A kula, leniency, is where, under certain circumstances, you obviously have to do this in conjunction with someone who can pass for the shayla, you're entitled to rely on a lenient opinion, even though the Shulchan Aruch rules strictly. Because that's an opinion out there. When the rabbi gives you a kula, it's not that the rabbi feels sorry for you and says, alright, let's be lenient. You know, I used to get this when I was a lawyer. When I say I have to go home on Friday afternoon for the Shabbat, they say, well, can't you ask for the rabbi rabbinic dispensation? They're thinking of it like Catholics, you know, that this is the law and the priest will give you a dispensation. There's no dispensation. The rabbi can't let you off the halakha. What the rabbi can do is he can say, look, the Shulchan Aruch has an X, but there is also opinion Y, which we don't normally follow. But in your circumstances, it's appropriate for you to follow opinion Y, because that was the opinion of whoever, even though that's not normally the normative opinion. But he didn't make that up. He wasn't just, like, easy on you. He just allowed you to follow another opinion in the Rishonim, which normally you wouldn't follow. Okay?
What's the word for meaning again?
Kula. That was from Taos. And meaning light. Okay? So look, you know, that was a really quick, probably far too quick, overview of the last 1500 years and how long it is today. I think a bunch of questions, not just on this, but generally for the last 15 minutes. Yes, Michelle?
I have two questions. So, in terms of authority, when you say like the big guns of each generation, like they have certain, they pass in a certain way. So are you, what authority do they have in terms of like you follow their opinion? Like, does it have to be through your local rabbi?
Right, they don't have any moral authority than any other rabbi, except that more of the Jewish people have adopted the following. The rabbi's authority today is limited to the extent that people wish to follow him. Someone like Rabbi Bani Yosef has the following of a vast number of people because they've decided to adopt him as their ultimate place for all the lesser reasons. And therefore, that's where his authority comes. Now, you might connect with Rabbi Bani Yosef through your rabbi. You might ask your rabbi Shaila, and he might say, "Ooh, this is a biggie. We need to go to someone serious for this," and he'll go to Rabbi Bani Yosef and you'll get it through there. Or you might go to Rabbi Bani Yosef. Now, it's dangerous to do the latter, because if you go to a gadol who doesn't really know you with a very personal shayla, then you might not get the answer that you need or that suits you, because he might not know you well enough, or he probably won't know you well enough, to understand the parameters of the case. Therefore, it's usually not a good idea to take a very personal shayla to a big gadol who is, you know, passing for Klal Yisrael, unless it's filtered through someone else who can really make it clearly explain. You'll get like 50 seconds with this person in order to put, you know, you can't do that. That's not what that would work. Yeah.
Okay, so when you were talking about another class, like, you can't just go around shopping for different, like, actors. Like, you can go to another rabbi if you think your rabbi got it wrong. But when it comes to, like, leniencies and humors, like, if your rabbi gives you, doesn't really, like, answer your shadow without really using some of the leniencies, like, that's not really wrong. So
that's
like,
not wrong.
Does that mean that you can't then, like, rely on some other opinion where it says that? Yeah.
Well, a rabbi will usually have a feel for when a leniency can and cannot be applied. It's not a free-for-all. You can't just say, well, I feel like I've had a hard life, therefore I need a leniency right now. Maybe you do, but maybe you don't. The leniency can only be applied within a framework of something called Bidiyah, there's something called Shabbat Hakana. Your rabbi needs to be going, if he feels that there's no appropriate leniency here, and he rules strictly, then that's a halacha. You may feel, if that starts to become a pattern in your life, that you need to get a new rabbi because he's not really seen up the line. He's, you know, if he thinks that you're some kind of, you know, you're someone from the neighbor, you know, who's going to jump off the roof if the rabbi tells you to jump off the roof, and he's passing in that witness, and you're not. Let's say someone who's a Baal Tshuva, and they're, you know, really kind of just deciding whether they should be religious or just about religious. There has to be an understanding of this person when you're ruling for them. And if the rabbi is giving chumra, people often do, by the way, for Baal Tshuva, which is totally inappropriate in most circumstances, then it's time for a new rabbi. So it just ends up, you know, making life very unfortunate. I know people who lost their relationship with their parents because they won't eat in their house, and they won't do this, and they won't do that, almost purely because the rabbi has given them a bunch of chumras to keep, which was completely inappropriate for the circumstances in which they were living. They should have been given a bunch of leniencies so that they could retain their relationship with their parents. And in the long term, that would have been much, much more halakhically sensible. Yeah?
I don't understand how all these things can all be right. Circumstantial? Like, is it subjective to everyone? Like, how can it all be right?
Well, right, nowadays, it's easy. There's two levels to that question. You kind of emailed me that question as well. If you're talking about pre-Talmud, how can all their opinions based on their analysis of the verses all necessarily be right? That's a different question to today. How can the Rambam and the Rashba and the Ritva all be right? Today, the answer is as follows. They're all based on analysis of the text. Text can be analysed in different ways, and the Gemara is deliberately open to different interpretations. That's how the Gemara is. And therefore, if you want to understand why the Rambam passes by the Rambam, so then you spend a few days or weeks or whatever learning this view of the Rambam in the Gemara, and then you understand how he's right. Because you'll see from the text how he heard it. It's not magic. It's not that they all say random different things and they're all right somehow. It's magic. They're based on a textual analysis. Any text, a text can be analysed in different ways. I'll give you an example just off the top of, you know, my head. When it says, when the Gemara says how long you have to wait from one meal to the next between milking places and milking, it says the Suda and the Suda, from one meal to the next meal. Now, does that mean a time frame between meals, like normally meals are eaten at 6 hour interval, therefore that's what the Gemara means? Or does it mean not in the same meal? If you're in one meal, you can't have milking some places, but once you bench and finish and clear away, then it's a new meal and then you can have more. These are legitimate ways of understanding that text. And that's how they're all right. They're not right in a magical way. They're right because they... Now, you have to understand how they got that from the text. And there's always a way of understanding it. You can understand their logic. Before the Talmud, understanding how Rabbi Akiva writes, Rabbi Shmuel writes, that's a rather different answer, which I haven't got time to get into now. It's just based on, you know, how different views of the experience of Sinai can both be correct. But it's not a textual analysis. Today it's a textual analysis. So it's easy to understand how there are five opinions because you learn the text and you'll come to those five opinions yourself if you're in it enough.
But
yeah?
But then, like, okay, what
do
you choose to hold back
as
a rabbi or whoever
is going to practice
in
that? Well, you won't choose to hold back anyone. You'll go to a rabbi. He will be Sadi, Ashkenazi, and Amalek, and he will hold back a certain Masorah.
Okay, but then, okay, fine, but then another rabbi will tell you what to do.
Yeah.
Is that going to be then
subjective? Oh, that's a very good question, which I just don't have time to get into, which I have a whole class on, which is, even when you've got to accept, there is still a way of applying that fact, which is very personal to the individual concerned. And there will be a level of subjectivity by the Rav as to how to understand and apply your particular circumstances. Definitely. It's not subjective in the sense of the analysis of the Talmud. The analysis of the Talmud is very objective. Now, of course, it's subjective to the point that the human brain is always subjective to some degree, but it puts to a very high standard of objectivity. But the way the Talmud will apply it to you will be very, very specific to you and him, and the way he sees the world, and Hashkafa, and a million other things, which will be subjective. So there is an element of subjectivity in that as well. It's not just it's not like a sausage machine, where you feed in your information, they crunch it through, and then an outcome's upset. And it's like one size fits all. That's not the way the halakha works, and it's not the way it should work. Yeah, sure.
I have kind of a broad question.
Yes.
How does one find a rabbi?
Right. That's a broad question. Yeah. Let me give you a 30-second answer. It's an intuitive process. You know who you are, and that's even not so straightforward, because you have to work out what person you are. Once you work out who you are, and that happens at the same time, certain rabbis you will feel that you are connected to, that you're tuned into. Now, of course, they have to be qualified. If you pick some random Joe who says he's a rabbi, and he's not, you know, and he says something different from the whole world, and he,
fine. A student is a guy who's plugged in. It has to be someone who's plugged in. You have to know where did you learn, where did you get your smicha, who were your rabbis, who were their rabbis. If he's part of a chain, which 99% of them will be, okay, so then it will be a kind of intuitive thing. You know, sometimes you go to people's shiurim and you feel, yes, I'm in the same kind of biorhythm as this rabbi, and sometimes you feel it's going like this. It's like some people down with the shabbos. Some people down with the shabbos, you think, wow, this is just how I could envisage my home looking in 15 years. And some people, you think, oh my goodness, this is very nice, but I never want to experience it again. You know that. It's a feeling. So you have to develop that. And you know, they obviously have something to respect, someone who you look up to, they have to have integrity, and you know, admit it, and all that kind of stuff. And then you work it out, but it's not so easy. But you need one. You have to find one, otherwise you're lost at sea. Yes.
How did all the Shaman like obtain their legitimacy? Like, who decided that it was
people who followed them?
So, but it was that everyone agreed that they were all legitimate? Like,
no, but pretty much everyone. Not everyone gave them the same weighting. Yeah, but everyone agreed that they're like. It's not even a question of an opinion. You can see from their analysis whether they're big people or whether they're pretending. The people who are Rishonim are Rishonim because they were brilliant minds. People recognized they were brilliant minds. The things they wrote were brilliant analysis, and they were followed by a large number of people. If they'd been fraud, they would have been found out on day two. Yeah? You can see. It's all very easy to at the time. This is all very scary. You just learn how to read it, and then you'll see the genius yourself, and you'll see why people follow them. But yes, of course, the diagnosis were disease needs to the people that live in Ashkenaz, but not necessarily to the people living in Yemen. We know that they were great rabbis, but we don't follow them. Yeah? Yeah.
I have a few questions.
Yeah.
First of all, what can I just learn Gemara on Shemir, which is Rosh Hashanah?
No, because learning Gemara is one thing, and passing Halacha is another thing. The Halacha is based on the Gemara. Of course, it's based on the Gemara, isn't it? But you and I just pass an Halacha based on the Gemara. We are born, are you Ashkenazi or Sephardi? So you are born into a society, yeah, which is collectively bound by a certain minhag. And minhag is binding. Minhag is binding under the rubric of a native, like a vow. Now, you never made that vow. You just happened to have been born into a society where that was the way people have a minhag. And therefore, you can't get out of that minhag unless you get out of that society. Which you can do. You can go live in, you know, Somalia. And then you'll be a whatever, you know, an African Jew. And they don't keep kicking. Or you can go live in Yemen. There are Jews living in Yemen or in Iran. And you won't have to keep kicking. But you can't live in New York and say, I'm a nationality, living in a nationality, and I keep Ashkenazi minhag and everything else, but I don't like the idea of kicking several months. You can't. Because it's inconsistent. Any more than your husband could sit around and say, I'm an Ashkenazi, and I like being a nationality, but I'm going to marry for one. You're going to sit around and say, well, hang on a minute, you can't do that.
Everything behind it.
But again, kidneys is a minhag. You can't learn anything behind it. You learn the whole Gemara, you find kidneys is allowed. The only reason you can't eat kidneys is because your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents decided not to. You can argue with them. You can argue with them. But yeah, you can't argue with the Gemara. The Gemara says you can eat kidneys.
Right. So I'm saying if you learn why it's permissible,
because it's not down there. The only reason it's prohibited is because people decided not to eat it. That's the only reason. You don't like that reason?
Okay, right. And so I'm saying learn why it was originally prohibited and learn why it's not applicable today, and then...
Minhag doesn't change that way. Minhag doesn't say, well, that used to be a minhag because of this reason is a bit different now, therefore the minhag is different. Minhag is the way people behave. It's not based on analysis. Therefore, if people still don't eat kidneys, I suppose you could argue that if the Ashkenazi world went on strike and decided en masse that they were going to all eat kidneys now, then your grandchildren could eat kidneys. But only because you would be naughty.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other question is, how is
the Shulchan Aruch
organized?
Yeah, that's a big question, which is only to answer, but I haven't got time. He divided it into four sections, which was a new division based on the Torah, which he modeled it on, which basically divides into daily life, sort of kashrus, and women's and men's issues, and it's just a different division. We can go through it, but not now.
And one more question. What do you make of like really fantastical midrashim that
you can't... Okay, good. So it's worthwhile just speaking about it for 1 minute. We didn't talk at all about midrash, but it's not part of oral law. It's not part of the halacha. It's part of a different system. The purpose of midrash is to communicate a sophisticated
theological, philosophical Jewish view. That's the purpose of this book. It is cloaked in the language of stories, in the language of the mystical, fantastical, etc. Your default position, every time you read a Midrash, your default position must be, this is how I look on my own, that the Midrash is not to be taken literally. Unless there's a really good reason why it is to be taken literally. That doesn't mean it's not to be taken seriously. And of course, it's obvious you take it literally, because you're not taking it seriously. Yeah? If the Midrash says that Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amos tall, and you have an image of somebody walking around the street who's 5 meters tall, who's like 70 feet tall, then you are belittling Chazal by making out that that's what they were saying about Moshe Rabbeinu, as opposed to what they were really saying about Moshe Rabbeinu, which is much deeper and much more fundamental, but which they closed in that language. So Midrashim are vastly misunderstood by most people. We think there's some kind of radical favor by saying you don't have to take them literally. Nobody takes Midrashim literally, apart from people who read the little Midrash there. Or even the big Midrash there.
I love that topic.
It's very nice. But it does lead you down the wrong road in thinking that this is like filling in the gaps between the Sukkim. That's what people think Midrashim are. That's very much not what they are.
Sometimes they're very particular. Like
they'll
get ages or
like, I don't know. Sometimes they are. But if it's not in the Sukkim. So Midrashim or the Midrashim disagree with each other. It's not something that you necessarily see. Even ages. Yeah.
You know how there are different space teams, like the shul, or this community yes. has a base team.
Yes.
Like, is there some kind of like system where you know you get one ruling from one base team? Is there an override from another base team?
No, just like I said before, just like a rabbi only has authority over people who wish to accept that authority today, so those who are the best in. Any community can pick three dayanim who are very qualified and say, we're going to have our communal Beis Din. That Beis Din only has authority of that community who wish to accept it. You could have a town with three or four Beis Din because there are communities within communities. And at the end of the day, if you don't want to be bound by a Beis Din, you don't have to be bound by a Beis Din. And that's one of the problems of going to Beis Din. If I take you to Beis Din, because I say you owe me $10,000, and you were just finishing that, and you say, I don't accept that Beis Din, I only go to this Beis Din. So then I'm going to go to that Beis Din, or we're going to find a third Beis Din which we're going to both accept. And if you don't like what they say, you can't appeal against them. It's like an arbitration. Even in American law, I think, you're bound by what you say you're going to be bound by. If you don't like them, then don't use them. Last such
an Isn't it unhealthy for the Jewish world, now that we're so globalized, and like we live in Eretz Israel, to have, sorry, you asked like, isn't it an issue in Israel with Kitneo, because like, what if you're invited to your Sephardi neighbor? So, honest, the rabbi is thinking like this just isn't healthy for the state.
So you're asking an excellent question, which we can end on, because your question goes forward, which is, shouldn't there be now a shift in the way that halakha works, given that we're in a new situation, we're living in Israel, maybe a Mashiach on the way, etc., etc.? And the answer is, depends who you ask. People who see Eretz Israel as a more sort of paradigm shift in the way that the Jewish people live will argue yes. Yeah, I can recommend things for you to read that will say that, and other people say no, and it really depends on your hashkafic view.
So when
is
that going to happen, though?
Like, yeah, that's a longer discussion, and we can see.
So quickly ask, so what about like, the issue of eating locusts, if that was a Yemenite custom? Is it wrong if I know what kind of locusts to eat now because the Yemenite brought it down? Is it wrong for me as an Ashkenazi to eat a locust if I know that it's kosher?
It's your Yemenite as a community not to eat those locusts. You can't eat them. If you go to a Yemenite for dinner, he gives you locust soup. So I'm not sure what you do in that situation. Mm-hmm. Or in dinner. You bring up your local Orthodox rabbi and say, you want that locust soup. It's a long conversation, but basically you can't eat it there. We got to yesterday the end of the Talmud, and the Talmud was finished around the year 500. What's been happening since then, for the last 1500 years of halakha? Now, as I said to you repeatedly at the end of the last class, the modern analysis of halakha, the oral words now, is entirely based on the Talmudic analysis. There's very little left oral. Maybe apart from Kabbalah and mysticism, there's very little left oral which is outside that. The way things therefore work now is as follows. The Talmud has been sealed, S-E-A-L-E-D, okay? Meaning that's it. You can't open it up again. Have a look, please. There's very few sources on today's sheet. If you look at source number one, the Gemara says about itself, Rebbe for Rebbe Natan, Sof Mishnah. Rebbe and Rebbe Natan were the end of the... You got it?
No, I'm
Rebbe and Rebbe Natan Sof Mishnah. Rebbe and Rebbe Natan were the end of the Mishnah. They put together the Mishnah and if you like, finished the Mishnah. Rav Ashi and Ravina Sof Hora'ah. Rav Ashi and Ravina are the end of Hora'ah. Hora'ah means ruling, means the end of the period at which the rulings of the Talmud were finally set down. And it's very important to understand that after that point, we cannot now open up the Talmud. The question is, why is that? If you look at this very important Rambam in source number 3, you'll see the following. The Rambam, in his introduction to his own halakhic quote, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, says the following. The Acha based in Shara of Ashi, after the basin of Ashi, Shechiba had Gemara, who composed the Gemara, the Gomru, and it was finished. It finished, be made benoni. In the days of his son, the son of Rav Ashi, what happened? Nitpazru Yisrael b'chol ha'arto. The Jewish people were then scattered across the world. Pizur yeter, a very significant dispersion. The yield of tzatzot, the yim harachim, they reached the very edges and the ends of the earth. The rafta katata ba'olam, there was a lot of struggle, there was a lot of trouble in the world. The Nishtafshu Hadrochim, and the roads became impassable, because of the armies. The Nishmat Talmud Torah, and Talmud Torah went down. The Long Nichna to Yisrael, little Moid Yeshiva, saying, I mean, the Jews no longer went in to learn in their yeshivas, Alafim Rurabavot, in their tens of thousands. Kamosha Hayom Mikhaida, like they used to do. We'll stop there for a second, we'll go on in a minute. The Rambam is describing a socio-political reality. Like I said to you many times, oral law responds to the environment of the world around it, not just in a little vacuum of its own. This is what we call the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages really, which are the end of the Roman Empire, and the Babylonian Empire also was collapsing, and the Jews became under pressure, the world became under pressure, there were sort of Vandals and Goths, and Saxons and all these people wandering around Europe chopping each other's heads off. Okay? And the Jews can't settle. They can't live. You can't pass on the road. You can't go anywhere. And therefore the Jewish religion itself went into a period of lack of introspection. There was never a time anymore after this point which all the Jews were together, like they were in Babel, okay, to accept a common authority of one document. And therefore, the reason the Talmud, according to the Rambam, is binding on the Jewish people is not necessarily because they were greater than we could ever be, although that may be true as well to some degree. It's because of a reality. We've never again been one community. After this point, you began to get a lot of division, bifurcation within the Jewish people. You ended up with the beginning of the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim. And the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim all share the same Talmud. But shortly after the Talmud was finished, they split into two communities. The Jews from Italy went north into France and Germany and founded the Ashkenazi community, and the Jews from Babel went to North Africa and Spain and founded the Sephardic community. And whilst they still based the halacha on the same Talmud, they began to have different minhagim, different ways of interpreting the Talmud, different ways of having their own customs. And no longer was there any one authority for the Jewish people. He expands on that now. Ella, I'm on the third line in the middle of the line. Rather, Nit Kav. There were little groups of individuals. Hapsurim, they were left over. Hashem Kareh, the whole ear of the ear, Hashem gathered together in every city, Chol Minam, united in every country. Oyeskim B'Torah, they learned Torah, or made Vinim B'Chiburei HaChachomim Kulam, and they borrowed their own Chachomim, what they put together. V'Yoyidim Mehem Derech HaMishpat, Heichum, and they learned how to pass the halacha from them. The whole Beit Din She'amad Achar Gemara, it's very important to learn. Every Beit Din that arises after the Gemara, B'chol Medina Medina, in any country in the world, the Gadar or Hitkin or Hintik, and he makes a decree or a ruling of some kind, or establishes a new custom, the Bnei Medina to the people in their city or town, or the Bnei Medina Rabot, or even for many towns or cities or countries, Loi Tashu Masa B'chol Yisrael, that cannot spread, or did not spread, and therefore has no bind, is not binding on the whole of the Jewish people. His name was Chayk Moshe, saying, because of the distance of their dwelling to where they live, the Shibush Hadrachim, and the fact that communication doesn't work between them. What he's saying, therefore, is that from the Gemara onwards, rabbis no longer have the same authority that they did. The rabbis, up until the time of the Gemara, had authority of this verse, as we said in the beginning of the Sefer Tal Shoshim, So we have a mitzvah, so this is the rabbis, and the rabbis have a mitzvah, they have smicha, and they are able to bind the Jewish people, they can create new laws, they can interpret, they can, they don't have it anymore. Therefore, all rabbis are today, after the Gemara, are local people with authority over the local community, if that community wants to accept that authority, and they cannot bind anyone else than the people who wish to be bound by them. Therefore, if some Sephardi rabbi makes a ruling, we're not going to eat fish and milk, even though the Gemara says fish and milk is fine together, chicken and milk is no good, but fish and milk is fine. Many Sephardi communities adopted a custom that they felt that just like chicken had been brought into Pleshik, because it looks a bit like meat. So fish, you know, fish burgers and chicken burgers, sometimes you know when you get a schnitzel, sometimes you're not sure, is it fish, is it chicken, what is it? So the Sephardi, so now they said, fish is going to be Pleshik too. Ashkenazim said, very nice, that's up to you, it's nothing to do with us, we're not bound by that, therefore you can do your thing, but we'll still eat fish and milk, because the time will serve it's fine. Similarly, Ashkenazim, for whatever reason, decided on Pesach, they didn't want to eat kidneys, and they decided, even though you want to say kidneys is 100% fine, they decided, for whatever sociological reasons, they had bad experiences in life, or they still was weak, etc. So the Ashkenazim said, we're not going to eat kidneys on Pesach. And the Sephardim said to them, bully for you, that's very nice, you cannot eat kidneys on Pesach, we are going to eat kidneys on Pesach because it's nothing to do with the Talmud, that's your minhag. The Ashkenazim decided we don't want to marry more than one wife, we're going to make a ban on marrying more than one wife, the Gemara doesn't make such a ban, although it discourages it, it doesn't say it's prohibited. The Ashkenazim said that's prohibited. The Sephardim said, you know something, it's not prohibited, but we agreed the bad thing to do, and therefore we're not going to write it in the halakha, but we're going to kind of promise our wives when we get married, but we won't marry otherwise. And if you listen to a Sephardi sugar on the chuppah, you'll see that a Sephardi does not have an extra line written in it. It says, I promise you, I won't take another wife apart from you. And Ashkenazi sugar doesn't have that, because I'm not allowed to anywhere, and Ashkenazi is not allowed. A Yemenite sugar doesn't have that in, and they never make any such promise. So if you marry a Yemenite guy, just get it all worked out in advance. Have me wives, and if you're going to be able to go on shidduchim with him. So what I'm saying is that from the Talmud onwards, it's all local custom. Local people interpret the Gemara to understand it how they understand it based on their tradition, and local people make new minhagim and new decrees, but for their own communities only. Okay? And the rabbi, therefore, today does not have any authority in the rabbis of Chazal, according to the Rambam. Certainly, there are differences of opinion on that, but let's take that as a basic view. Therefore, you don't have to listen to your rabbi because he's imbued with the authority of Chazal. You have to listen to him because you've chosen to listen to him. If you want to get a new rabbi, then it's fine, pitch that rabbi, get a new rabbi. Okay? You cannot get rid of Chazal because Chazal have a different authority. They have the authority of the Pesukim in the Torah, and therefore their word on the halakha is the final word. And therefore we never take the halakhic process further back than the Gemara. Now, this is around the end yesterday. This is the difference between us and the conservative movement. The conservative movement reinvented a new halakhic methodology when they founded their movement at the end, beginning of the 1900s. And they said, you know something, we are going to pick apart the Gemara if we feel like it. And Rabbi Akiva says this, and Rabbi Greenberg down the road doesn't agree, so fine, we'll go with Rabbi Greenberg and not Rabbi Akiva. We won't say that. We'll say, look, at the end of the day, the halacha, as defined by the Gemara, is, that's the bottom line. Now, of course, it's not always that straightforward to decide what the Gemara concludes. And that is a process of interpretation and understanding, which is why, in the end, the halacha may be different if you're a Sephardi, or if you're an Ashkenazi, okay? Or if you're whatever. But at the end of the day, it's all based on Talmudic analysis. Now, you asked the question yesterday, how can it be, therefore, the Talmudic analysis from 1500 years ago still have all the necessary tools to enable us to decide on technological change and new things and surrogate mothers and light bulbs on Shabbos and all these kind of things. The answer is it does, and you just have to know how to read it right. One of the purposes of my Tuesday afternoon contemporary issues class is to show how the answers to all these contemporary issues are found in the Gemara. The Gemara talks at length in various different places about animals and people having been conceived by one mother and given birth to by a different mother. Of course, it doesn't talk about it in the context of surrogate, you know, operations, because they didn't have it. But it talks about the principle, and all I'm looking for is the principle. The application just follows the principle. It doesn't talk about light bulbs on Shabbos, but it does talk about metal, and making metal red hot on Shabbos, whether that's allowed or not allowed. And that's what a light bulb is at the end of the day, it's a piece of little metal, which makes red hot on Shabbos. And therefore, the principle is the same, the application is different. Now, sometimes even the principles are different. What's a fluorescent light bulb? There's no metal in there, how does that work? There's a whole different discussion. But everything ultimately is based on the halakha.